My name is Mary and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful to be here and so grateful to be sober. And I would like to thank Polly so very much for inviting me to this wonderful event. And she's sitting holding Hillary. And I think that God sings his song through Hillary for us. Beautiful. And I'd like to thank Lee and John and all you wonderful speakers that have been here and shared your wisdom. I mean, I just feel so blessed for the women I have in my life. And for my sponsee, Cheryl, and I don't know where Deb is. Maybe she took off. But my heart's very full. You know, I was talking yesterday about my granddaughter making her first communion today. And having the song sang for her, Amazing Grace. And I was looking around this room this morning, and I was getting these things I get sometimes when I get these little moments of ecstasy. You know, they're not even moments, they're almost like seconds. And it's just, you just feel the presence of God. And I was thinking, my Lord, look at this. What, is this not Amazing Grace? That saved a wretch like me. That once we were lost and now I'm found, was blind and now I see. Thank you, God, for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. Because, you see, I used to live in the street. Because, you see, I used to be taken up and used by a man and thrown away like an old piece of cloth. I used to have people spitting at me. I used to lie down at people's feet and beg them to give me a few cents to buy liquor. I never thought that I could ever, ever walk again with my head up and look at people in the eye. I used to walk, even when I came into AA for a long time, with my head down because I was so full of shame. I was filled with shame. I was filled with remorse. I was filled with guilt. I was a broken human being. And Alcoholics Anonymous, through the wonderful time and benefits of Bill and Bob and all the people that came and all the old timers, what they gave and created for us. And what a miracle it is that we're celebrating 80 years today. 80 years of recovery from a hopeless condition of mind and body that is produced by an innocuous little substance called alcohol. Well, we think it's alcohol. We think it's alcohol. But we don't really know until we get here and start doing the work that it's so much more. And it's through the honesty of the wonderful speakers we have here that tell us really what we're like way deep down inside. And how the wonderful work can be done. You know, when Michelangelo created that beautiful statue of David, the people went to him and said, "How did you create that gorgeous piece of marble that is David? How did you create that out this old that old chip thing I saw lying here?" And he said, "I chipped away the parts that weren't David." And that's what God does with us. Through the working of the steps, he chips away the parts to get down to the essence of being that he wants us to be, so that we can be ultimately of use to others. That's what it's all about. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. And what is a spiritual awakening? It's defined in Appendix 2 of the Big Book as a change of personality sufficient to bring about recovery from the illness of alcoholism. So what is it really, a change of personality? What is this personality change? Well, what this spiritual awakening means in this change of personality is I'm going to be able to do, see, feel and believe things I could not do, see, feel and believe on my own unaided will. I am going to be recreated. I am so very happy about that. You see, because there was something wrong with me long before I ever took a drink. You see, I always knew there was something wrong with me. I didn't know I needed a spiritual awakening. That certainly was not in my head. But I always knew there was something seriously wrong with me from when I had conscious thought. And the reason I knew there was something seriously wrong with me is because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with you. And how did that manifest? Well, have you read the article, This Matter of Fear? That's a wonderful article. Because in that article that Bill wrote, The Matter of Fear, he talks about all of these things that were there before he took a drink. And my God, when I read that, that's me. You know, he spoke about the feeling awkward around people. He spoke about feelings of difference from he was very young. He spoke about feeling as if he was always on the outside looking in. He spoke about having this sort of a very nervous disorder. Here's the difference. I've watched people and spoken to a lot of people and sponsored some people who are dual addicts, and they tell me what cocaine did for them. Now, I've never had any illegal drugs. Like Polly, I had all the yum-yums, the Librium, the Valium, the yum-yum-yum-yum. Right? when these wonderful women I sponsored talked to me, I didn't drink to get high. You see, I was born on high alert. Like, I came out. I mean, they were dropping bombs on my country when I was born. I was born in Glasgow, Scotland. You know, and they were bombing the Clyde when I was born. I mean, that's, you kind of come in the road and say, what the hell is that? You know. Well, let me back in there, you know. Is that mummy? By the way, that's what some men do in AA today. They go about looking for a nurse and a person. Mummy? Not mummy. Oh, and men too, you know. I mean, women do it too. Daddy, not daddy. But anyway, that's another thing. So, it's wonderful to be able to laugh at it. Because like Bill Wilson too, you know, when Bill's girlfriend Bertha died, he realized that the one thing he could never fight was death. And he started having panic attacks. And he started having an obsession with death. By the way, thank you, Amanda. You did such a fantastic job. I'm sorry. I meant to mention. And that's what happened to me. At about age 13, I became obsessed with death. You think that's funny? I became absolutely and totally obsessed with death. I became obsessed with eternity. I became obsessed. I was born into a very strong Roman Catholic family. And my mother was president of the Union of Catholic Mothers. My mother never went out without her gloves. God love her. Her gloves and her hat. My mother was a lady. She used to pretend to read her paper and she'd be looking at me like this. And I'd say to her, what are you looking at? She'd say, I don't know where you came from. Now, that does not inspire confidence. I was not like my mother. And God, I had thrown away God a long time ago. I was, you know, I know Al-Anon never give us much credit for this, but alcoholics have high IQs. But the only thing that does is we never complete anything we ever start. And we get bored very quickly. And, I was educated by nuns. And they were wonderful people. Today I love nuns. I make amends to them whenever I can see them. And, But you know, I didn't get on well in the convent I was educated in. I just didn't settle down because I really couldn't settle anywhere. And I couldn't take instruction. And I couldn't sit long in one space. And they tried to teach me all the wonderful things that they had to give to me. And I didn't want to receive that. And at 15, one of them hit me and I hit her back. And, oh, come on. Shocked. Who in here hasn't hit a nun? Really? But here's the thing. You know, when Bill used to talk about, he spoke once about being in the cathedral in England and for a moment had this thing with God. And I think God is always, this is how I used to think about, when I was moving away from God, it was an awful rowing away. It was an awful, lonely, isolated, slow by slow rowing away from God. And then I get in here. And I start working the steps and I start rowing towards God. I'm rowing towards God. And he's got his life jacket and he's got the big boat and he's got all the goodies just waiting to take me out of that sea and the depths of despair that I used to be in. The awful rowing away from God and the rowing towards God. It's such a beautiful thing. But you know, when I was expelled that day, we get the consequences of our actions. We all know that. And when I was expelled that day, the Mother Superior took me outside her room and she said to me, if you sit down and memorize that sign above my door while you wait for your poor mother to come and pick you up, it might do something for your measly little life. And I looked at this thing and it said, of courtesy it is much less than courage of heart or holiness. But in the walks to me, it seems that the grace of God is in courtesy. And way back then, I wanted nothing to do with the grace of God, and I wanted nothing to do with courtesy. But many years later, coming through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, a broken person coming from the street, it was the grace of God that brought me here. And it was the courtesy that you extended to me that made me feel that I belonged. And I am so grateful because it came true for me. And I'll show you one other little, you know, God gives us hints and guesses that he hasn't abandoned us. It's me who has left my God. Because my God sits within me and is with me always until I finally just crack open. With me, I had to crack open with despair. My darling mother, both my parents died before I got sober. And I'm going to share two little things with you because it came into my mind this morning. I don't know why. And one of them I've spoken about many times. And this is how I came, how I got into the program. I'd had a slip and I'd had a few months sobriety and I'd had a slip. And that night, some AA people came and took me to a meeting. I was in really bad shape. They told me I was shaking so much, strangers were waving back at me. You know what it's like. Like, kind of like Polly last night. And that night, a little girl did this 12-step. She did a 12-step. She had 11 years sobriety. She did a 12-step. She stayed with me. And the next morning, she stayed with me so I wouldn't have DTs, because I've had DTs, and I used to wake up biting my tongue. And the next morning, she said to me, I'm going to leave you now, because my sponsor said you're a loser. And I only stick with winners in Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the third step prayer. And I said to her, I kneel for nothing. And then something said, think of your children's eyes. And what I thought about was the night before, was the Christmas before, I'd just come out of the mental institution one more time. I was filled with medication. My children had been taken away from me I'd gone back to Jamaica. The children's father asked if he could have them for a week, and they were gone for 13 years. And that was just after that I hit the street in Miami. But anyway, I wanted to see my kids, and I'd just come out of the mental institution. I was full of drugs. I called my family in Scotland. I said, call Jamaica, see if I can see my boys for Christmas. And he said, my family phoned back and said, call the father. He said, you can come to Jamaica, you can rent a place. We have a Jamaican here, by the way. Hi, darling, so good to see you. What happened, my man? Everything good? Boy, me really love you, you know. And so I went down to Jamaica, and I did a... The father said, you have to stay in the Pegasus Hotel. I'll come and check on you three times a day or whenever, to make sure you're not drinking. I'll have someone bring the boys to the airport. And he put my boys on the phone. They said, Mommy, I can't believe you're coming for Christmas. We heard that you were in hospital and we don't know where you've been, because I was always missing in action. My poor little boys. You know, 11 and 7, living without their mommy. Nobody took us away the boo-boos because of this illness of alcoholism. So I asked them what they want for Christmas. I bought all the Christmas presents. I get on the plane in Edmonton, Alberta. I get off in Toronto to get Air Jamaica to Kingston, Jamaica, and I buy a bottle of vodka. And between Toronto and Kingston, I drink the whole bottle. And when I get off the plane in Kingston Airport, my son shouts, Mommy! And I drop down drunk at their feet. And the person who brought them said, you won't be seeing your mother this trip. And I remember lying on the ground and seeing the pieces of Christmas paper, my children being led away, crying, and looking over the shoulder at me with the eyes of the child of the alcoholic, the broken promises and broken dreams one more time. And that is what I thought about that morning, 10th of August, 1984, when I knelt down and said, God, I offer myself to thee. The beginning of my contact, and I had such despair that I was cracked open. Like William James said in the Varieties of Religious Experience, the common denominator that used to get all those Water Street mission drunks, Mr. Hadley and all those other people he was written about, all the winos, the ones that came off the street and were now becoming upstanding citizens. And he said, what happened to you guys? And they had all reached a place of absolute and complete despair and hopelessness. And that is the aperture for God's grace. For God's amazing grace is the despair. What happened was, some people came and took me to a hotel and said, we'll put you on a plane in the morning. And I called my mother in Scotland. And I didn't know my mother was dying of ovarian cancer. And my mother said to me, what happened to my big lassie? The alcohol is killing my lassie. She said, I want you to get on the plane and remember the dignity of your ancestors. And I got back, and I found my mother only had a few months to live. And I decided I wouldn't drink and I'd go to Scotland. And I went to Scotland. And my mother had always said the only way she'd ever get to see her only grandchildren, my sons, was if she was dying. And he brought them up from Jamaica to see my mother. But before my kids arrived, I said, Mommy... Because she looked like one of these people at a concentration camp with a big stomach with the ovarian cancer and skinny, skinny little soul. You could blow her away. She wasn't even 5 foot. I said, what do you want to do, Mom? She said, drive me up to the Highlands. She wanted to drive to the Highlands of Scotland. And I drove her up. My mother loved the bagpipes. She used to say it made her blood boil. And it was a beautiful day, and I was going very slowly, and there was no wind to bother her, because she was so little it would have blown her away. And she said, put the windows down a wee bit. And I did. I hear bagpipes. And I think, am I having auditory hallucinations? You know, is this wishful thinking? Because if you know the Highlands in Scotland, they're just vast tracts of hills and land and narrow little road we're on. And I hear the bagpipes. And I drive round and I see a piper in full Scottish dress standing on top of a hill playing the bagpipes. And I thought that that was a moment God was coming to me. How could you arrange? No, I found out afterwards he used to do that every year, because I won't get into it, but the history of the Highlands is that the English took the land away from us. And that's how you had all the people coming to the States and everywhere else. So that's why it's so empty. And he would come and play for his tribe that used to live there once a year. But he was there at that moment in time for my mother. You cannot arrange this. God is great. Thank you, God, for my mom. Thank you. We say in AA, coincidence is God's way of staying anonymous. It sounds so simple, doesn't it? Yeah. So, like, you know, like Bill Wilson, I was neurotic. You know, this fear of death I had, it was all-encompassing. And the panic attacks, has anybody in here had panic attacks? Yeah, they're horrible, aren't they? They are completely and utterly isolating. Doesn't matter who's standing before you, who loves you, they can't penetrate once you go in there. It is a state of insanity. It's horrible. So I had all of this going on with me, and it's funny, you know. I used to try and be like my friends. When Marilyn talks about spaceship, that's what I used to think. I used to think I've come from some other planet, you know. Beam me up, Scotty, you know. But the wanting to be like everybody else. You see, what I had was, and what I think alcoholism is when you boil it down, it is an incredible, unsheddable burden of self-consciousness. An unsheddable, incredible burden of self-consciousness. You can't get rid of it. You are utterly and totally encased in self. And it is not a healthy self. It is the kind of self that everywhere you go, you think that everybody's looking at you and finding you wanting. You think that everywhere you go, everybody's looking at you and saying, she's not enough. And it never leaves. It is a pathological concentration on self. And there's no way to get out of that except a drink. But I didn't know that then. And I decided I was going to be like my friends and date. So I go out with this guy, and I don't know if the guy's in America like the guy's in Scotland. After they take you out, they want a reward. And this fellow's getting kind of a, you know, kissy. And, you know, it's 16, you know. And I said to him, so what do you think about death? And he said, I think you should go home now, you know. So you see, the great beauty and freedom that I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm able to laugh at this stuff now. Who could I talk about like that? My mother knew I was not right. I mean, every year I've got Irish, Scottish and a little English blood. It's kind of like having Maggie Thatcher, St. Patrick and Braveheart all rolled into one. And you know, every year my mother would take me to Ireland, and this is why I need the personality change. This is what I'm telling, for me, everybody's not like this. There are those who are suffer from grave mental and emotional disorders. This is why I needed a personality change. This is why psychiatrists said that Alcoholics Anonymous with the 12 steps can accomplish more in 20 years, in a couple of years than they can in 20, if ever. Because you see, I was diagnosed as having an abnormal personality. A disordered personality. Okay. So that's why I needed this. It was so important for me to read that I could have this. When I went to Ireland every year, my family, I have Irish family, live in Drogheda, and they'd come and they'd say to my mother, "She's not right, you know." That's me. "And if you're not right in Ireland, you're not right anywhere." Yeah. I mean, Ireland is an open air asylum. You know, I'm telling you. And then they'd take me down, and there was this big, beautiful cathedral in Drogheda. And on the altar is a glass case with the head of a martyred saint. His name is Blessed, was at that time, he's now a saint, was Blessed Oliver Plunkett. And he'd been hung, drawn, and quartered by the English and burnt. They couldn't think of enough things to do to this guy. So all you have sitting in this case is a black head with teeth. He still had his teeth. 300 years. And my family used to sit me in the front and said, "I want you to really sit and study Blessed Oliver Plunkett, because he really, really loved God." I thought, if he really loved God, I want something more than that. So that, you know, it says in our literature, a seeming inability to accept much on faith. My mother, her mother, my father was a Franciscan monk. My father had left the monastery because he didn't get on with that. It was not for any nefarious reasons. He just didn't get on with the teachings. And he joined the Second World War. And he was with my mother's two brothers when they were both killed. And he came to Scotland because he was born in England. I did to tell my mother's mother that her two sons, he'd known them. And one was buried in Greece and one in Belgium. And like Marilyn talked about, and Sandy Beach, my grandmother just went to God. My mother just went to God. I didn't understand it because I couldn't. I didn't have it in me. It just wasn't there. It's almost like sometimes I think that the saint for the alcoholic should be Dalton Thomas. Because it's almost like we have to have knowledge. Faith is not enough. Faith is not enough. We've got to have knowledge of God. Which is what Carl Jung used to talk about. I won't get into that, but he called it... He was a Gnostic. G-N-O-S-T-I-C. And what a Gnostic is means you have knowledge rather than faith. But you know what? We're all sitting here today with knowledge. Because we all know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that we were beyond human aid. Do we know that? We all know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that God has recovered us from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Do we not know that? Yeah, we know that. So like Bill Wilson, I coped with these fears by becoming very aggressive. Very, very aggressive. I started lying, cheating, stealing. I started running with street gangs in Glasgow. Doesn't look like it today, does it? But I did. Shocking my poor mother, you know. In Glasgow we have Irish and we have Protestants and Catholics, and you know, it's almost like Northern Ireland. And my mother was horrified, and I was very aggressive, believe me, extremely aggressive. So that's the whole package that I was running with from when I was like 15. Now, what happened to Bill was Bill found somebody eventually that he could love. And I thought, I didn't know Bill's story then, but that's more or less. I went down to London, England. I went into nursing because I wanted to clean up my act. And I hadn't even drank yet. I wanted to please my mum. I love my mum. And I love my little brother and my dad. And I wanted to do something good, but I couldn't hang in at anything. And I got bored with nursing. I went to London, England. I'm flying all over the world on a plane, having panic attacks. Don't like people. Not a good scenario, let me tell you. And eventually I get married. And I think, oh gosh, if I get married, I'll be good. And I married a nice man, and he married a figment of my imagination. And he took me to live in Jamaica, and I had everything that money could buy. And then my first son was born, and I am telling you, the love I have for my two little boys, well, my first son, I've never known anything like it before. You know what it's like when you hold your first child in your arms. It is something that there are no words for, because it's all coming from pure love. Pure, pure love. And I hold that little boy and I think, my God, could I have created something this perfect? I'll always love you. Always. And 2 weeks after he's born, I thought I was going insane. I'm going back into a panic attack. I'm in the room with him. I'm looking out. My husband belonged to an old rum family in Jamaica. And he had 5 homes in the island. And I'm in this beautiful home and looking out. And there's the heliconia and the anthurium and the doctor birds and all the beauty that is Jamaica. And I'm inside with this beautiful child and it's darkness coming over me. And I'm going to have another panic attack. And I'm going to go mad this time. I'll never come back. And they bring a doctor and he wants to give me Valium. And a friend of mine came and said, give her a drink. My spiritual awakening. You see, alcohol produced in me a change of personality. It was a spirit awakening to a solution that I had been looking for all my life. And Jamaica has 151 proof rum. Right, darling? It's beautiful. And I immediately drank on a daily basis. And I drank a lot. And after 4 years, you know, women go down the road quicker than men. And after I drank every day I carried my second child. I have to tell you that, because by the time I was pregnant, I had lost the power of choice in drink. And I carried that child. I drank every day. And I don't know, I could not say it's the grace of God why he doesn't have fetal alcohol syndrome. Because I've known beautiful women that have a little child with fetal alcohol syndrome. And God didn't love them any more than he loved me. God, you know, what does Clancy say? The rain falls on the just and the unjust. Yeah. And so I have these two little boys and I'm a hopeless alcoholic. My husband's a nervous wreck. You know. All of my husbands have had chronic nervous conditions. And eventually I decide I'm going to leave the island. Some friends of mine came because I caused a lot of trouble in Jamaica. Believe it or not. And because I was, you see, again, I stopped being a lady. The alcohol allowed me to be a lady, you see. I could go to the country club and I could be anything you wanted me to be. And then I drink and I become aggressive again. And I become a street fighter. And I attack dry cleaners because I don't like how they've done my clothes. And they call the police. And my friends said to me, Mary, they took me up into the mountains because they realized I needed something. They thought I needed marijuana. Oh. Now, I have never smoked ganja. Like Polly, I've never smoked ganja. But they took me up into the hills because there's a group of people called Rastafarians. And these Rastafarians are very spiritual people. And they, alcohol is against their religion. And they call God Jah. And they read from the Old Testament. They're very spiritual. But they smoke a lot of pot. And so my friends, trying to help me. There's always been good people. They took me up into the mountains. And I watched these people and they'd roll a spliff and it was so big you couldn't even see their face. And they would go,
I just want a bell of out, man. have a little vision.
See, spiritual in nature. And they'd, and then they'd lie down and contemplate spirit. I drink spirit. You know, I don't want to lie down. You know, when I drink, I want justice and love and action. I will eventually lie down whether I want to or not. So then I took these little boys and I took them to Canada. I married a man I shouldn't have married, a lovely man. God bless him, I hurt him a lot. And I sent him away. You know, Cheryl and I laugh. See, here's what happened to me. I've been married 4 times. Clancy told me I'm just one of those women maybe that shouldn't have been married. I tried. My personality is such, I adore my boys. I adore my grandkids. I can't live with a man for very long. I love them. And when I was young, and thank God it's all gone now because the estrogen is gone and Duck's disease setting in. You know? And I'm happy with that because it's so freeing when you don't have that anymore, because sex used to move me around. You know, it moved me around. It did. I mean, it did. Not that I was would just go and have sex with anybody, but you know, it was almost like I'd go on a sabbatical. You know, no, I would. You know, I would go for a long period of not having any sex whatsoever, and then suddenly I'd see something I like. And I'm going to go for that and marry it. Right? I mean, that's how it was for me, you know, because it was all in my mind. And then after him and I would be like Velcro. And then after about 3 weeks, the thrill is gone. I can hear him breathing 3 doors down. Did he always breathe like that? You see, there's nothing wrong with that nice man. The problem, as Polly says, is within me. I am the problem. And those to my two little boys, we lived in Canada for 2 years. And I will tell you this, I was a hopeless alcoholic when I landed in Canada. I'm sorry to go to your country, Lynn, like that. You know, when my second husband said, I'll take you to live in Canada, I thought, what a good idea. Drink Canada dry. And so I sent that nice man away. And it was just me and my two little boys. I never physically abused my children, but it's definitely psychological abuse of the mother who's the alcoholic, you know. And my poor little boys, you know, they'd sometimes without my knowing it, they'd wake up at night and I'd have brought a man home and I wouldn't know they saw me. And the next morning my boy would say to me, Mommy, who was that man that was here last night? And I would say, there was no man, you were dreaming. And I had my children question their reality, which was one of the great living amends I am still making today. And then I'd drive with them drunk in the car. And then my little boy would say to me, Mommy, they want us to cook a Jamaican dish to bring to school. Could you cook it? Little Marky. He was only 5 when I took him to Canada. And I'd say, okay. And I'd wake up in the morning and I'd say, I'm going to cook the chicken and take it to school. And I won't drink. And then I'd start shaking. And I'm knowing I can go. Because you see, I have what I had before I drank, which is the incredible, unsheddable burden of self-consciousness. I just don't know how to mix with people. And I'm also now a drunk. I'm taking all of that to the school. And I'm trying to be normal. And they don't understand. So I've got to have a drink to finish this chicken. To take it from my boy. And I never can have a drink because I don't know I have a phenomenon of craving. I don't know that. Why didn't I start with the second drink, not the first?
I don't think like that anymore, but...
And I remember this day going down to school. And my wee boy's out there saying, "Mommy, Mommy, my mommy brought the chicken." And it was snowing. And I slid and fell down. And I had it on a glass plate. And the plate broke. And the chicken's all over the snow. And I'm half drunk. That's the legacy I would have if I wasn't able to come and do these steps. How could I ever live with these things consciously? And after a couple of years, I decided I'll go back to Jamaica because we need the daddy. And my eldest son, God calling? My eldest son, 11 years old, had to make a decision that no child should ever have to make, and it's made by children of alcoholics. And what he had to do was he wrote to his father without telling me. And he said to his daddy in the letter, "When I come back to Jamaica, I don't want to be with mommy anymore because she brings men home that I don't know. And she drives with us drunk in the car. And she's going to kill my little brother and me." And I didn't know he'd written that letter. And when I get off the plane and the father asked if he could have them for a week, I say, "Sure." He said, "Give me the passports, I'll take them to Disney World." And after a week I said, "When are you bringing my boys?" He said, "You won't get them back because you're a drunk and a lush." And I'll put my son in the stand. He said, "And remember, he who holds the gold makes the rules." And I had my first suicide attempt. And I ended up living in an old rundown. Oh, they phoned me and they pumped out my stomach. And the psychiatrist told me something the next morning that was very observant, intellectually correct, and definitely relevant to my condition. The psychiatrist said to me, "You mustn't do that anymore." And one night I'm sitting drinking myself sober. And have you ever done that? Drink yourself sober and start thinking that maybe a man can get me out of this. I'm living in an old rundown hotel. And, here's what happens, you know, when you're a woman drunk and you're looking for a ticket out. And I'd find a nice man who drank like me, an old expat from America or somewhere. And him and I would have a few drinks and he'd begin to look real good. And he'd tell me I look beautiful. And him and I would wander into the enchanted cottage. The only thing is, the sun comes up, the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization of being with a stranger one more time. And I walked out of that hotel one morning with this escort of the night before, and a car passed by with my ex-husband, his new wife, and my two sons, as if prearranged. And my ex-husband came and said, "If you don't leave the island, I'll kill you. Because you're shaming my children, you're shaming me, you're shaming our name. We've been here for a long, long time, and you're shaming us. I'll kill you, or I'll have you killed." And he gave me the money he owed me for the 2 years I'd been in Canada, the child support, and that's how I ended up in Miami. And the last thing I'll share with you, because my parents are very much in my mind this Sunday morning, is that when I was living on the street, my father had said to my mother at 3 o'clock in the morning one morning, "I don't know where my lassie is. And I don't know where my grandchildren are. And I'm going for a walk." And he dropped dead in the street. The same time I was living on the street. So, when I come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have no argument with this. Because I'm done. I've been everywhere there is to go. I know now beyond a shadow of a doubt, no doctor can ever fix me. No medication can ever fix me. I have no God. I'm beyond human aid. There's a thing in here and I love it. And I always talk about it in my talk. In step 12, 109. Where was it? Okay. You know, they're talking about the doubter who claims they haven't got the spiritual angle, which I always love. They're sitting there sober on a Sunday morning. They haven't got the spiritual angle. Please. Is this where you'd normally be on a Sunday morning? The doubter who claimed he hadn't got the spiritual angle and who still considered his well-loved AA group, the higher power, would presently love God and call him by name. The man who 12-stepped me was a Metis. Am I saying that correctly, Lynn? A Metis? Yeah. It's an Aboriginal French Canadian. And he had 28 years sobriety. And he came and he told me his story. And he said, "Tell me some of your story, Mary." And I did. And he said, "I think you're one of us." And nobody had ever said that to me before. I said, "Stan, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm also nuts. I have a psychiatric report that says I'm nuts." He said, "Mary, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches to fit any nut that comes through the door." He says, "Just come in." I said, "And I don't have a God. I don't. Just come in." And you know, after that thing happened to me in the third step when I never wanted to drink, I didn't know what had happened to me. I just knew I did not want to drink. It was like miraculous. I didn't want to drink. I wasn't even fighting drink. I mean, 10th of August, 9th of August, I'm drunk. 10th of August, I don't want to drink. And I don't want to drink any day after that. What is this but a miracle of healing? And so then, but I still didn't have a God. Bill Wilson was my higher power. And I had a great sponsor. And one day, the old timer said, "You've got to find a God and call him by name." He said, "You've got to find a higher power and call him by name." So I go around looking for a higher power. And I hear this old woman speak. And the messenger comes in various shapes and sizes. And I heard this old woman, and she was the most spiritual woman I'd ever heard. And she'd had a hard life. And she was singing her song to God from the podium, giving her talk. And I went up to her afterwards. I said, "Helen, you love your God. Who is this God you have? I'm looking for a God." She said, "Mary, my God's called Harold." I said, "Harold?" She said, "Yep, you know that prayer, 'Our Father who art in heaven, Harold be thy name.'" I call him by name. So here's the deal. You know, it promises that the consciousness of the presence of God will be the greatest factor of your life today. The consciousness of the presence of God becomes the greatest factor of your life today. That is what has happened to me. God has recovered me from a hopeless condition of mind and body. God has recovered me from, I don't have panic attacks anymore. Since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on the 10th of August 1984, I have not had any psychiatric medication. No, I'm not a doctor. Hi. Yeah. I am not a doctor. Please. Please. I sponsor two women who are truly bipolar. The previous sponsor took them off their medication. It has taken the doctor almost a year to get these women back. The damage that was done to these women is horrendous. So I'm just saying, for me, I haven't needed psychiatric medication since the 10th of August 1984. A couple of times I felt like I was having a panic attack over the years. Just a couple of times. And you know what I do? The minute I feel it coming on, and it's not been for a long time now, God is so strong within me. I just say, "God, God, God, God." And I woke up, because once upon a time when it came on, I'd start running up and down. I mean, just horrendous. And now I just stop, and then I say, "God, God, God, God." And it goes away. It goes away. you know, I try to explain this to psychiatrists. They think I'm nuts. They do. My husband had, I'm going to tell you about my husband. My husband, I got married in AA. I love people who are married well in AA. I have seen the most beautiful marriages in Alcoholics Anonymous. Really. Beautiful, beautiful marriages. I got my, here's the thing. Talk about spiritual awakenings. When I was 2 years sober, because I'd done all the steps and a couple of times, and I think I've had a spiritual awakening. And the old timers used to say to me, no relationships for a year, but for you it's two. Because you have a propensity for getting married. So I'm 2 years sober, I'm spiritually fit. I go to a meeting on a Sunday morning, I look down the table and I saw him. And I just knew that God had sent me my reward. And I still go to a lot of meetings, and somebody, and he'd go to a lot of meetings, and somebody would ask me to read How It Works, and my eyes would flit across a crowded room. And I had a vision of John and me walking off into the sunset, under the circle and the triangle. With Bill and Bob up in heaven saying, bless you, my child. Carl Jung just to the side. And I said, I'm going to share this with my sponsor. My sponsor at the time was Rini, who died with 53 years sobriety. Powerhouse woman. Love women alcoholics. Was active in AA every day till she died. She's the one that used to tell me, if God guides, God provides. You know, she used to phone me every morning. So I went to Rini, who, by the way, had no, she was beautiful, but had no romance in her soul. And I shared with her my vision. And she said, don't get married, you're an emotional retard. And I knew she was jealous. Kitty. I knew. So John and I eloped. And anyway, it didn't work out well, you know. Because John was attracted to me and I was still crazy. You see, like attracts like. I will attract my insides on the outside until I'm ready to, until I've had the amount of spiritual awakening that I need. I needed a lot of change of personality. And it's ongoing still. That was another spiritual thing, because even although him and I separated, eventually I found him one day. He'd had a massive stroke. We lived in the same building. I found him. If I hadn't gone into his apartment to check on him, they said he'd be dead in 8 hours. And he was a brilliant guy. He'd been a lawyer, and he had had the whole half his brain was gone, and he could never speak again, and he couldn't understand the spoken word. If you said touch your nose, John, he wouldn't know what you're saying. And he had right arm paralysis, and the only two words he could say, I can't say from the podium. But they mean take a journey. And he said them to everybody. And after a couple of years in hospital, I took him home. And that was the most spiritual form of loving I've ever known. Because I have never seen a human being suffer as much as I saw John suffer. And eventually he choked to death. And he loved states. And I knew he was still in there because he used to draw me maps on the I-90 to Florida to tell me where he wanted me to take him. And I showed this to the psychiatrist. He said, boy, he's so brilliant. The part of one brain's taken over the function it used to be. I mean, really. And as we cross the border into the US, he'd take out his US flag and wave it. When I'm in Georgia, and I'll just share this with you, because I was thinking about it. One time I had him in Florida, and we're driving back, and he had a way of letting me know where the little boy's room is. And I was speeding, and a cop stopped me in Georgia. And he said, you know how fast you're going, lady? I said, it's my husband. John's sitting with his flag, and he's... and his hand on his, you know, where he needs to go to the washroom. And then the cop looks at, I said, he's got incredible brain damage. I said, he doesn't speak, my husband. He said, well, I'm sorry, lady, I'll have to give you a ticket. I said, will you take a check? He said, we don't take Canadian checks. He said, but the ATM's conveniently located next to the police station. So we get around there and we get out, and this very nice policeman goes around to help my husband out in the car. And my husband says, take a journey, you know. And the cop said, I thought you said he couldn't speak. I said, that's all he knows. Honestly, God. Okay, so I'm going to, how much time do I have? Okay, thank you, Lee. Oh, by the way, thank you. I said thank you, Lee. Thank you, Lee. Okay, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I'm able to do, see, feel, and believe things I could not do, see, feel, and believe my own unaided will. Try to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. You know, the night before I left, I did a 12-step call. I love 12-step calls. We don't get them anymore. I love fresh meat. Oh, don't you love it? You know why? It takes me right back. God always gives me one like me. Because it seems to be attraction rather than promotion. And I always get the one that is as sick as me. I do. Because when I'm talking to them, they go, oh yeah. And you can see they've still got psychosis. You know? You know that, I call it reality psychosis. Is this the real world? You know, And I got this one just the night before I came here. And you know, she's, God bless her, I'm not going to tell her story here, but she's almost done. You know, but like, you know, like me, she's one of those that's been hitting bottom and she just keeps going through bottom. Bottom after bottom after bottom. And you see, we don't die easy. Alcoholics are hard to dead. When people say, I know if I drink again I'll be dead, I say, you wish. Forever and ever and ever drinking. She said, what do you want me to do? I'll do anything. I said, okay, I'm going to sponsor you. I'm going to give you the name of this, one of my oldest sponsees. You know, she's a great girl. And I said, you talk to her every day when I'm away. And I told her the meetings I wanted to go to. And she said, so I said, now I want you to read, you know, doctor's opinion. And, you know, I told her what I wanted her to read. And I want you to write a little bit about that, how you identify. And I said, so this is what we're going to do now. Because, see, I can only tell people how to get sober the way I got sober. And this is how they told me to get sober. 90 meetings in 90 days. Now, I went to 3 a day. But I said, sure, 90 meetings in 90 days. If you don't like what you hear, I'll gladly refund you your misery. Right? She's got a big book. She's got a sponsor. I'll try and get her as active as I can when I get back there. She said to me, what? I said, 90 meetings in 90 days, but you're downtown Toronto and you can get to 3 a day. I don't think I can do that. I said, you don't think you can do that? You're dying. She said, well, you know, I'll go, how about one a week? I said, what are you doing? You're living at the Sally Ann. She said, I'll try to do the other stuff, but I don't think I can go to all those meetings. There I am looking into the eyes of alcoholism. You see, until I could become completely teachable, until I resign from the debating society. And you can only do that through degradation, humiliation, despair. And I don't know what it takes for each individual one. So we'll see what happens when I get back. I'm hoping too that she'll have thought about it, that Mother Sponsee Anne has spoken to her. And so I'm going to wrap it up by talking about practice these principles in all our affairs. I can't remember where it is. There's some place, it's a letter that Bill Wilson wrote in 1959. And he's talking about how eventually it's not just enough for us to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not just enough for us to be working with alcoholics. We have to go out into our families and out into the world and become citizens of the world. I love that. And, you know, I had my moments of being citizens of the world. And I've had my moments of thinking I have great spiritual. I'll just share this with you. How I'm really good most days. I get up, it's contingent. Every morning I wake up, as Polly was talking about, I have a spiritual release contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, right? So I wake up every morning, I'm waking up with the active illness of alcoholism. I've got to get in fit spiritual condition before I go out there where there'll be dragons called people, places and things. Okay? So that I don't get that finger and all of that. And one morning, some days you wake up, and my sponsor called them grey chiffon days. You know the material chiffon? It's just a grey chiffon day. It's a day when that little ability I have to go into depression will just be there one more time. It's just my alcoholism talking to me. I've done all the do's, I've done everything I'm supposed to do, but it just, every now and then, not often, every now and then. And I'm not in fit spiritual condition, but I think I am. So one morning I knew that there was... Okay, I've got to share this with you. Deb, okay, I'll tell you this. Deb's got a beautiful boyfriend called Glenn. He sent me this. I'll put it on here. And I'm going to tell this story why he sent this to me. All the way from California, shipped it. It's a box of tissues with flowers on them. He heard me tell this story. One morning I go out, I hear that my pharmacy is having a sale on tissue boxes. And I want tissue boxes because they're very cheap. And my nose is always running. And so I go down there and this woman has hit the store before me. And they have them in these big bins. And she's pulling out all the ones with flowers on them. Now, I have never given a fig about what the external of a tissue box looks like. You know, I could care less. But I decide I'm going to be a citizen of the world. And point out the gross unfairness So I said to her, "Excuse me, you're pulling out all the boxes with flowers on them." She said, "I only like the ones with flowers on them." I said, "Me too." And her and I are jostling each other for these. And in the end, she's got 11 and I've got one. And she said to me, "Give me that and I'll have a dozen." I said, "No." And then I said to myself, she walked away. She said, "Gee." And she walked away. And I thought, just a minute here. I'm 70. I'm 30 years sober. I call my sponsor. She said, "A bit immature, wasn't it?" She said, "I want you to drive with the box in your car till you see that lady again." So that's one of my being citizens of the world. I live a good life today. You know, my sons came back to. I went up and down to Jamaica many times. I'm not doing the 8th and 9th that were so beautifully covered here. But I made my amends by flying up and down to Jamaica and making amends. And once my sponsor, Rini, when my children were kicked out of their father's home, they were 15 and 18 or something, 14 and 15 and 18. I said, you know, Rini, I don't know what to do. I wonder if I should go back to Jamaica. And Rini said, yes, I think you should go back to Jamaica and make amends to the island. And I did go back and got my children off. One of them was at the Florida Air Academy in Melbourne, Florida, and had been there. And he wanted then to go to Scotland, and sent them to my family in Scotland. He wanted to go there for a while. And my eldest son wanted to go to Broward Community College because his friends were going there. And got them off there. And I spent 2 years in the island working in alcohol, you know, trying to help. I mean, I was working. I had to be working. I also was... get very active in Alcoholics Anonymous because there's not a lot of sobriety there, and came back and started. My sons then were ready to come back with me, and we all lived together for a couple of years. And you see, my eldest son, the one who wrote the letter, he said, "Mommy, I always knew you loved me. I never doubted for a minute you loved me. I just knew you were very sick, you know." And my eldest son has always been very Catholic, and thank God it's his religion. It's kept because he had a terrible trouble with anger. My son is not a drinker, but you see, because he went through with me, even though he's never blamed me ever, he just made that decision. But he's never ever blamed me, and always loved me, and I've always been in their life, drunk or so. I've always tried to get them, the awful road towards my children. You know, always, because that's constant. And how it affected my eldest son was, without the spiritual life that he has, I don't know how he would have survived. He got married, and he's a good husband, and he had little children. He loves them very much, but he had a rage and anger in him, and it prevented him from working. I mean, really bad rage. We're talking horrible rage. And he said he inherited it. He used to call me Napalm. I wasn't like that with them, but with others. And one time I got the feeling that something... You know, you get that intuitive thought? And I flew out there, and this is like 7 years ago. And he picked me up, and he was sweating. And he looked like he'd put on a lot of weight. And he'd been in and out of jobs. And I said, "Son, what's wrong?" He said, "I'm okay, Mom." And we went home, and he went upstairs to lie down. I said to his wife, "He never does that. Something's going on." I said, "Right." And I took him to a doctor's. His blood pressure was about to blow. His cholesterol was sky high. He was a walker. He could have died. And I stayed out there. Now, this sometimes it's great to be sober in our mature children's lives, even if we weren't there for them when they were young. And I stayed out there, and I took him and had resume written. And, you know, his father's a very high-powered guy, and he loves his father, make no mistake. But my son decided he didn't want to do anything more than he wanted to sell cars. He's a top salesperson in Subaru in Canada. He's just bought a $450,000 home. He took off like a bullet in the last 7 years. He is amazing. And he's the one that said he's going to have amazing grace. He was with his father, and his father, you know, he said he uses the 12 steps in his life. That's how he lives his life. And he's got little AA things all over the wall. My youngest son never talks about my alcoholism. He was 7 when he was taken away. Never discussed it. I try and bring him in. And 4 years ago, he has a fabulous job in Aruba. And he sent me a first class ticket. My children love me. I mean, they send me, if you ever see, you know, WhatsApp messages, they're always sending me, "Love you, Mom, where are you?" I always let them know where I am. Always. And he sent me a first class ticket, and I went to Aruba, and he has a beautiful home.
home there, and he has his swimming pool, and it was gorgeous. We had a great time together. And at that time, oh no, this is longer than 7 years ago, because my little granddaughter was only seven. And it was getting dark outside, and my son was sitting with his back to me. And I said, "Son, don't you think you should bring in children? It's getting dark outside." And without even turning around, he said to me, "So where was I when I was seven, Mum?" You see, he won't talk about it, but it's right there. Whereas my eldest son has spoken about it until you know everything about him. So my life today is beyond my wildest dreams. I am so very grateful. You know, I did, when I was speaking in San Antonio at the flag ceremony, that's what she was talking about. Because something came over me when I was asked to do that. And it is humbling. And not only that, I'm thinking to myself, my God, once upon a time, I used to walk in the shadows. I was so ashamed. I couldn't look at people. And here I am facing, 60,000 people? And that's why I said that, you know, I'm so grateful to the United States of America. Because if it wasn't for the freedom of religious thought that this country allows their citizens to have, Bill and Bob would not have been allowed to found this on a God of your own understanding. So I thank you for my life. Thank you.